also sort of have my window open.
Yeah.
So God knows what it's recording.
Ghosts.
I'm vaguely afraid of that.
You're going to be listening one week and it's going to be like, Cassidy.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again is my regular co-host, Richard Wally.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from California.
Yeah, I forgot to say where you're from. You're from Portland, Oregon. It's late. I don't know what I'm doing.
You've been at work all day.
I'm winding down in my brain, and so I have to, like, recharge it. I have to, like, pull out the generator to my brain and give it a few pumps just to get through this podcast.
It happens.
So I'm a cyborg now. I didn't know if you...
You're just a low-tech one because you have to use gas and... have to give it a few pumps. It's like a chainsaw.
Right.
Got to pull on the cord a few times.
So you were talking earlier, before we started recording, that you saw a projection of Ken Russell's The Devils, 1970, 71?
Yeah, it was a 35mm print.
Supposedly looked, the unedited...
It's like, the X-rated version, yes.
Yeah, with the quote-unquote Rape of Christ scene still in it.
Oh, is that what that was supposed to be? Okay.
That's the sequence that was... that never made it to a DVD copy because it was one of the films that was in the British video nasties. So it wasn't released for a really, really long time. And then it was, but then it was only released with like specific cuts. And that scene was never put on a DVD or Blu-ray copy, which still has never been released in America. But you can buy, I think, a Region 2 DVD from the UK or an all-region version.
Right.
Why don't you talk a little bit about this crazy movie? I've seen it before.
This is the thing. Is it really that crazy? I didn't think it was that crazy. It's a Ken Russell film. So, I mean, he's one of those... He's probably as good as, like, any director out there, really.
Yeah.
I'm talking about bigger names, you know. But
his contemporaries at the time, sure.
He's got a really... a lot of his movies, even some of the lesser well-regarded ones that I've seen, all have this really, really, like atmosphere to them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just very energetic films. This film is set in somewhere between the Renaissance and the Dark Ages, I think. I think they specifically said the 17th century.
France?
It is France, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's basically about the battle for this, like, city between, what the movie's about. It's about, like, 50 different things.
Right.
But there's a city, and there's this Jesuit priest who's got this manly mustache, and he's going around banging all the broads in town, and... he gets one pregnant who happens to be one of the rich people of the city, and lots of in and outs and things happening. And basically it comes down to different religious factions fighting it out and kind of an Inquisition-esque exploration of that. In film.
Right. You know, like a Catholic priest who's...
Jesuit priest. Yeah.
Openly cool with like sleeping with people. Which is kind of taboo. Well, more than taboo at the time. And then on top of it, there's all these nuns lusting after him.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is crazy about the movie isn't necessarily the plot dynamics. Because, I mean, it's based on like an Aldous Huxley book. So, I mean, the storytelling is kind of classically told.
Sure.
But it's the hysteria of the movie. It just gets wilder and wilder as it goes. Like the stuff with the nuns who are writhing in like lustful... like almost demonic possession kind of stuff. And it predates The Exorcist as far as some of that goes. And like this idea of sort of like lust and demonic influence kind of being interlinked throughout the movie, but then also like government influence and the way that they're like using religion as a way of like
singling people out
and
controlling the populace.
Controlling them through governmental ways. Like, and then on top of it, I don't know if you had like somebody to like introduce a movie or anything like that. When I saw it projected at the Arrow down here in Santa Monica, they did it with a double bill with a documentary about fuck, what, and I can't think of his name. I gotta look it up. Hold on.
If we're talking in tone, it's more of a subdued horror, like The Witch.
Right.
And it's also
Devils was one of those movies I thought about when I watched The Witch.
Oh, absolutely.
Not necessarily in tone per se, or even style.
No, I was gonna say tone or style. It's more like take The Witch and mix it with like The Wicker Man.
Yes.
And that's what that's kind of what the movie is. I dug the movie, but I do. Maybe it's just modern aesthetics and things like that compared to the 70s. But it was hard for me to kind of tap into what was like specifically so demented and horrible about this movie that it's so hard to find still to this day. So I was like, yeah, this is an Inquisition film. Everybody knows about the Inquisition.
It's kind of, I guess, tame by like extremist standards. Like it's not like a high tension or whatever, but it's I think it was just because people thought it was just extremely blasphemous.
Well, I didn't, like you said, the Jesus rape scene, I guess that's what was happening. It seems like they just, if it was, it was the most classy rape scene ever.
You can put that on the re-release DVD whenever it comes out. The person I was thinking about was Derek Jarman. Derek Jarman was a famous gay filmmaker who made a bunch of movies from like the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. Most famously did Caravaggio and Sebastian. And like he was the one who discovered Tilda Swinton and made her a thing.
Right.
But he was a production designer on The Devils.
Oh.
So a lot of the production, which is, it's very, very stylized.
Yeah. I mean, the movie looks great. And even the 35 millimeter copy that we watched was
well taken care of.
Yeah, it was in pretty good condition. I just thinking about it, like, I get that if you're deeply religious, Or you're easily offended. Why this film? You know, yeah, I get it for the time, but like, but I mean, now it's still hard to find, and still, you know, that's where I get a little kind of
right. Weird. Now I think it's more like legal stuff. It's like, whose estate does it belong to? Ken Russell's dead now. He might have not wanted to release it for whatever reason. He was kind of a weird guy. Yeah, I think it was one of those kind of legal red tape. Whose movie is it anyway? Like, is it still the studio, or if the studio who made it, like, it no longer exists, and like who bought the rights, and if they have it, like, you know, whose library is it in, and blah 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 blah.
Sure. But I mean, kind of probably similar kind of to The Wicker Man. I did like the film. I think it is, it's a little bit of a head scratcher. You do have to kind of pay attention. It's very manic. Kind of in a nice way, though.
it builds up to that. It starts out very like a traditional sort of period piece, but then it just becomes more and more insane as it goes. And debaucherous. I think that's what it's one of those movies like The Wicker Man where you don't really know what to call it. Is it a horror movie? Is it a period piece? Is it almost kind of like an exploration of camp? I mean, the whole thing is just kind of bizarre. I mean, there's versions of it you can see. I can't tell the audience, if they're listening, what version is out there. Like, I saw a version of it on YouTube originally, which was probably to rip from an old VHS or something.
Sure.
And that's how I originally saw it before I saw it projected. So, if it's playing in your city, try and see it if you can. at like a rep house or something like that. If not, you know, there, I think there's an all region DVD that's available. You can like overspend like $30-$50 on
yeah, Amazon. There's also a bootleg out there that's a really, really poor quality, but it actually, it's
probably the same one I saw, that VHS rip.
I think so. Well, there's also, well, there's another bootleg copy that has, somebody way after the fact, found like additional reels that he added back into the film as well. That's not part of the X version. It's not part of the rated R version. So, there's also, so there are three different versions. If you're a very traditional religious, you probably won't dig this film. So maybe stick away from it then, but. Other than that, if you, I think if you liked like Wicker Man or
yeah, if you like wild like that, 70s cinema, that's
that important. Too, yeah.
But yeah, today the movies we're actually going to be talking about. I didn't know we were going to fit in a full review of The Devils, but that's cool. Finding Dory, I'm going to be reviewing, but you did not see.
I did not see. I refused.
And you're going to be reviewing Warcraft, which I wasn't able to see, and The Conjuring 2, The Conjuring. Which I didn't see because I didn't know we were going to, or that you were going to.
You told me that we were supposed to go see Warcraft because you had a lot, you thought it would spark a very big conversation. So,
which now we're not going to be able to have, but yeah. But yes. And then for our Netflix homework, we're going to be talking about the low budget horror film Hush. But the other thing we should talk about at the top of the show, I suppose. Anton Yelchin died really randomly.
Yeah.
Yesterday or the day before.
Yeah, really. This really bums me out. I mean, we've lost a lot of prominent figures this year, but it always makes me, I don't know, for me, it makes it worse when it's somebody who's young and I don't feel like has reached that status. And I really think he was a great actor who under the right guidance could have really put out some great films. And I think Green Room was kind of heading in that direction. I know we disagree on that film, but. I've been a big fan since Charlie Bartlett came out, and I was always waiting for him to really, hit a stride and, stupid car companies. Holy cow.
I didn't know the full story about like how he died. I just heard car accidents. So I assumed like, you know, whatever, like people die in car accidents all the time. Not whatever, kind of like who cares that he died, but whatever, like it couldn't have been something totally bizarre.
It was a
freak accident. He ended up getting killed by his own car because he went to get his mail and his vehicle went from neutral to reverse and backed up on him and pinned him against his own gate.
Yeah, it was one of those recalls for, I think it was Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do have a car, you should probably check into that. We actually received, we received a recall notice on our car, and they had improperly packed the passenger side airbag. And so what it would do is when it would explode, it actually shoot fragment into the person sitting in the passenger seat. So they instead of an airbag, they packed a grenade into our car. So there are some pretty serious recalls out there, and
right,
these things need to get taken care of. Again, it's just sad that it happened to such a young, and these ones really bum me out. Like,
yeah,
like somebody like David Bowie, he reached his pinnacle. Nobody's gonna fucking say that David Bowie didn't reach his pinnacle, even if you're not a huge fan or whatever. But sad.
It's a bummer.
That young dies.
It's a bummer.
Yeah,
and yeah, you know, I think he had so much potential. And I was really kind of liking where he was going. Now he's getting older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I really liked him in Only Lovers Left Alive.
Oh, yeah. He was like everybody was really fun in that. But I dug that movie.
Yeah, he was like a really fun character in that. And then, yeah, I liked him in, I think us and a lot of people sort of discovered him in Charlie Bartlett. Mm-hmm. He was really good in the Fright Night remake. That was much better than it should have been.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And then, of course, he was Chekhov in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies. And the third one is still coming out. So this was a big year for him between that and Green Room.
Yeah, definitely he was heading towards a bigger potential, I think. I hope, because I always hoped for him. And he was a great actor, and it's, again, it's a bummer.
So yeah, I just kind of wanted to bring that up, but let's go ahead and get into our movie news, and we're going to try and run through these quickly. Mallrats 2, which was originally going to be set up by Kevin Smith, is now apparently going to become a 10-episode TV series. So there's that.
I don't know if this is good or bad. He tends to...
It is what it is.
It is what it is. A lot of people are really, like, excited about the episode of The Flash he directed. But specifically with The Flash, it kind of constrains him because it makes him work under the DC label. He can only do so many things. He can't have weird, like, Canadian bacon people or whatever.
Whatever's going on.
in the newest film that he's going to be doing.
Yeah. But
he can kind of do, you can do kind of a weird dramedy, comedy, more edging towards comedy in TV series in a different way. And yeah. So maybe he can get some of that extra, like, he always wants to put in 50,000 ideas. So maybe a TV series is the way to do it.
Possibly. Here's my fear with him doing Mallrats anything.
Mm-hmm.
Mallrats is one of his broadest comedies.
Yes.
I think so. And I think that if he returns to it, he's going to want to... It's one of those fan things, right? Because we've talked about him at length, and I think he's one of those directors who really is beholden to his fans. But I feel like the influence of his fans, like, is really detrimental sometimes to the work that he ends up making. And I think that if he tried to do a Mallrats anything, whether it was a movie or a TV series, and try and do it too much like 1996 Mallrats, I don't think it would play very well.
Well, that was kind of pre, like, the big comic book boom. And so it's kind of...
It's pre a lot of things.
Yeah. And I mean, in a way, it's kind of, I guess it's
very much a product of its time.
It's very much a product of its time, but it also kind of, like, there were a lot of things that were happening in it that kind of told you where he was going, one.
Yeah.
And two, it also told you kind of a lot of the things that are popular or not so popular in that show are now popular. Also, you got, like, Ben Affleck playing a rapist, all sorts
of weird stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. And who knows how many of those people would come back. I mean, probably a lot of them he's still friends with. Claire Forlani, I haven't seen in a million years. And apparently, what's her face from 90210 is not, like.
Well, that's what I was wondering. The old, like, these people are, like, they're not there now. Yeah. So what the hell is this film? What would this TV show even be about?
Jeremy London, like, yeah. Jason London. I forget which one it is.
Whatever twin. Anyways.
Yeah. This one?
Mel Gibson planning Passion of the Christ sequel. That's the only perfect response to that. I mean, I read
Revenge it. Revenge of the Christ? Like, what is this movie?
Yeah, that's some of the things that I was hearing, too. Like, the Christ again or whatever. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about it instead of being like more of a passion play, it would be like an actual resurrection tale. And that's sort of interesting because they never really focus on that part of the whole Jesus stuff. So in a way it could be interesting.
Didn't they just do that movie though with Draco Malfoy and,
could be. Yeah. I don't know.
And Ralph Fiennes' little brother, like that, like,
oh yeah, he was like a Roman
soldier who fell asleep on the job when he was guarding Christ's tomb, and then it becomes a political thriller for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know what this is gonna be. The first Passion of the Christ was our first documented torture porn. I don't know. Basically, what popped up is to laugh. So I don't have much more to say about it.
I mean, we haven't seen a movie from Mel in a long time.
That's true, too.
And God knows what he's been up to.
Drinking.
Like, and, yeah, screaming anti-Semitic things into the night sky. I don't know. Here's the thing. He's actually not a bad filmmaker.
No, like, I don't say think what he's, you want he's about not a bad this. Actor either.
No, he's totally insane. And he's completely unhinged and probably has a lot of problems. and he used to be a very good actor. I haven't seen him as an actor in a movie in a long time either. But if you look at his actual movies, you know, Passion of the Christ for what it is, and Braveheart, which I think is a little overrated, but, you know, people like it. and Apocalypto. Like, he's actually a very studied, competent filmmaker, and he makes movies with a lot of atmosphere and that are always hyper-violent. But he's not, like, as far as, like, actors turned directors, he's not the by far the worst one.
No, he is talented. It's just that weird thing where you actually care about who these people are.
Right.
Like, I just want to see a good product. I don't have any illusions that these are, you know, great people or whatever.
Right.
So maybe they are, some of them, but a lot of them, I'm going to guess, they're just people. Yeah, it's yours.
Sicario sequel, Soldado, will be part of a standalone trilogy. This isn't going to be directed by Denis Villeneuve. But we loved Sicario last year.
Yeah, Sicario was a very good movie. It was just a tense thriller. It really was kind of a throwback to Silence of the Lambs. I heard some people complain about it for various reasons. I thought all their reasons were dumb. It was one of my favorite films last year.
It was by far one of my favorite movies. It was like,
yeah,
even past the ones that I probably placed in front of it, for various different reasons, that was still one of my favorite movie going experiences, like sitting in a theater and just like being, you know, lulled into the world that the movie was creating. Now, all of that said, that's almost all on Denis Villeneuve and Roger Deakins and that film crew.
Agreed.
So who knows if a sequel is going to be that. It might end up more like the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo directed DVD sequels.
Could be.
TV movie sequels. I mean, they're going to be released in theaters and everything. But what I mean is, like,
well, it just depends on who they're going to put in there. Right. I mean, that it doesn't really talk about. It just says that we have standalone. So I was kind of thinking of like True Detective.
Sure.
The first season versus second season. And sometimes you can't get that lightning in a bottle, even if you bring everybody back. So I'm cautiously interested. I know that Josh Brolin and Del Toro, Benicio Del Toro, are going to return. What that means, I don't know.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I'm with you. I think I love Sicario, the first one, but I don't know what this... I just don't know what it's going to be. Especially without... Because to me, that's such a director's movie.
Very much so. And again, it depends on who they bring in. I'm curious, and I'm going to wait until I see that. And then I'll be like, okay, maybe this will be good. Like, maybe they bring in somebody that you wouldn't be prepared for, you know? So.
Right. Okay. This one, Eli Roth will direct Bruce Willis in a Death Wish remake. Of course he will.
There's been actually a lot of Eli Roth, because there was another article that came out about him, but, I don't really have a lot to say about this. Bruce Willis has been doing a lot of these kind of actioneers that he's kind of like. It's kind of like somebody kind of going back to the football quarterback trying to go back to their heyday. Feels like that anyways. I mean, I kind of feel like a jerk for saying that, but it may or may not be true. Eli Roth, I think. See, this is my opinion of Eli Roth. I'm kind of in between the two consensus of him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I don't think he's a great storyteller, but I think he has some like genuine moments of being a great director. And so I think if you got somebody behind him who was a stronger storyteller, could guide that process. I think there is a possibility to make a really great film.
That really great film is going to be a remake of Death Wish, though.
Weirder things have happened. remakes are beholden to somebody who has a real idea of what they want to do with it. I have no idea, though, but pretty much, no, it doesn't sound that way to me.
Right. I have a pretty good idea of what Eli Roth wants to do with Death Wish. He's just going to make it super gory. Shoot, because he's Eli Roth. I think he's the Zack Snyder of horror. Like, I think he's an emperor with no clothes. And I have no idea why he's still a thing. And why his movies don't go straight to DVD. Although that pretty much did happen with his last two, Knock Knock and not Green Zone. What was it called?
The Green Inferno.
Yeah.
Yeah, those Green Zone sounds like a football movie.
No, that was a war movie with Matt Damon. But anyway, let's get into the movie reviews, because this is the longest podcast we've ever recorded. Why don't you go ahead and give us a little review, a taste of what you thought about Warcraft.
Warcraft is directed by Duncan Jones. It has a huge cast. But what's interesting about it is you actually start off with this orc clan, and you're started off in this devastated world, and you see them being led through this portal into this other fantasy realm where there's humans and other mythical elfy things or whatever the hell those were. But basically you see this kind of this first meeting of these two different clans and these two different cultures and peoples. And you see kind of the inner politics of them coming together. Now, this is kind of done in your kind of more bigger, I've said this in a more sophisticated way, but it's really kind of more in your blockbustery, kind of almost like Western, but facilitated through your basic kind of fantasy.
Kind of post-Tolkien stuff. Yeah,
but what's interesting about this specifically is that they have what typically are bad guys in the movie, the orcs. They have heroic orcs. And they have heroic humans, and they have villainous orcs and villainous humans. And so you get this kind of strange interaction between the two things. So it is kind of the actual story is kind of more elaborate than some of these can. And it's not necessarily as like 70s Tolkien, like smoking pot piece, weird hippie stuff. It's very much, this might be one of the nerdiest movies I've ever watched. Very much a video game movie.
And it is but based I don't on a video game by Blizzard.
Well, a long running one too that has legions of fans.
Yeah.
I actually fell positively on this movie. I mean, it's not very deep. It's not very complex. It kind of, I would say, falls into your Pacific Rim kind of territory. But I think that it's got its own kind of style to it, and it's got its own kind of interesting mythos that. I would be more interested to come back to it. But if you have a hard time specifically with, I think, like visual effects, like specifically like characters that are visually effects driven, this one is like 90%, well not 90%, but like a good chunk of the film is that. And it's hard to kind of sometimes reconcile that aspect. But overall, I think that they're very well done. It's just that, this film doesn't try to go for realisticness, which is a big deal. Like, this isn't like a Planet of the Apes, where these are like, they're trying to work this kind of, well, this old idea, but they do it very realistic with these monkeys and do it little bit by little bit. This is a full blown orcs, humans, fantasy realm kind of movie.
Yeah.
And they don't make any qualms about that. And they don't try to make, and sometimes they kind of leave some of the stuff almost cartoony, but looking very much like the games would. And so you feel, I feel like the world works within within itself.
You're able to get into the world after a while.
Well, no, I was in there from the get go. And I mean, I'll be honest, I was much, I wasn't cheering for the humor, the humans. In fact, I thought some of their performances, as well as one of the orcs' performances, who was a non-digital character, because she's a half orc, half human, were kind of wooden. But the orcs, I thought, were actually really, like, the acting was actually really well done by them.
Okay. And
I was way more into them than I was the human characters, because it's more the novelty of what their society and stuff's like, and I just usually like monsters more than humans.
Right.
So I don't know. I could see, I don't think that you would like this movie that much, honestly. I might be caught by surprise. This might be one of those weird ones where I'm like, oh, you did like it? Okay, I guess.
I have two questions.
Okay.
I had three, but you answered one of them, which I was going to say, how did you feel about the animation? The other one would be, is this basically a Campbellian hero's journey? Like you said, it's not like Lord of the Rings, and that it's not all peace pipey and whatever Sauron da da da. But is it basically like a young whatever has to discover himself or herself by doing a thing and a journey and whatever?
It has a little bit. It does have some of that, just because. But again, like, but more through the guise of like the storytelling of like a Western, where you have, where, and specifically if you have cowboys versus Indians.
Sure.
And, I mean, there is some of that, but it's the Campbellian stuff, I think, is kind of, it's toned down because you have, I think it's pretty easy to follow. There's a pretty, I think for people who may be into like kind of the Tolkien stuff and kind of can get behind this nerdy thing, but don't have the years of mythology that is behind World of Warcraft. Mm-hmm. I think you can kind of settle into it pretty easily. I mean, it is, you have to be able to accept that there's these portals and magic and people are walking through, and it does have some video game like mechanics to their magic and stuff. But okay. I thought that was kind of neat because instead of it just being like instantaneous, you kind of had to focus and build up, and there was kind of some like inner workings of how magic worked in the film. So
okay, second question.
Okay,
could this have been made by anybody else besides Duncan Jones? Is there anything about this movie where you go, oh, this is definitely a Duncan Jones movie?
I wouldn't say that there is, like, this isn't Moon or Source Code. This isn't either of those films. I would say no. I would say that the complicated balancing of the two stories done by a lesser filmmaker could make the film a lot dumber and a lot harder to follow. There's not an easy answer to that, because I think that he does bring something to it, but I don't think it's a full like artistic auteur kind of vision. It is very much like they were making a Warcraft movie.
Okay. Well, for the most part, it sounds like you're pretty positive, but this movie didn't do very well in theaters, and it was not very well critically received. It didn't
do very well domestically.
Oh, yeah. I guess China's all about it, but...
It is doing fantastic in China. Like,
good for Blizzard and Duncan Jones, because they needed to do well somewhere. But what is there anything about it you'd see as an obvious negative?
Again, like I said, when I said that it's like Pacific Rim, it's not necessarily that deep or elaborate, or I mean, it's kind of almost like family stories,
mm-hmm.
like two tribes, you know, and their different families and stuff like that, and kind of a drama in that sense. But I mean, it's not like it's some dudes in armor versus some orcs. Like, I mean, it's not, it's a Warcraft movie. Like I said, there's a certain audience that I think would be very turned off by this. I kind of just enjoyed it. I didn't really have to put a thinking cap on through it. So it's a little pedestrian, okay. I suppose you could say.
All right.
I know some people, I don't know. I have a hard time because I heard some like nerdy people who are really into World of Warcraft saying how that they should have done the film, and while we were watching the credits, and it was like literally the worst idea I've ever heard. I wish I could remember some of the details, and I did for the show last week, but it was literally, I was like, this is already one of the most nerdy movies I've ever watched. Adding all of that stuff would make it 30 times worse. Please do not take this kid's notes ever. I'm sure that they wouldn't, but
right.
But I don't know. So it's kind of a weird, it's weird because I think that they're trying to appease both audiences, like kind of a more generalist and kind of in watch and do it at two levels. But I think it kind of waters down what the thing can be. I'm actually, and also because it's kind of an origin story, and the last few years origin stories have been all the rage. And so I get a little, it's weird because you almost get to the point where you're like, I'm more interested in the sequel. All
right.
Than I am in this one. So,
which probably won't happen.
I think you're wrong. It's doing really well overseas, Cassidy. It will not be geared domestically.
Okay.
But it has been breaking like box office, and it has more than made up its money in China.
Okay.
Like it made $150 million in China. China alone. Just China. We're not talking around the world.
Right.
And so in a lot of those other markets, too, I'm sure it does very well. I don't know if the sequel will do very well. And again, I understand why the critical response wasn't huge. But again, I think that this is a perfectly, I thought it was a fun popcorn movie.
Okay. I saw Finding Dory, which is Disney Pixar sequel, Finding Nemo, which came out in what, like 2005? No, that would have been earlier than that. High school. Like 2003,
yeah,
probably. Yeah, like a million years ago. And I think we talked about Pixar last summer when we did our review of Inside Out.
I think we did a retrospective.
A retrospective. And we talked about some of our favorite movies of theirs and whatever. You were never a big Finding Nemo fan.
Never. Still not. Won't be. You can't make me.
And but I said, you know, whether you're a fan or not, monetarily, it was a huge hit for them. And it was kind of a big second wind in their sales. And I think it really kind of helped the studio sort of carry on through to the 2000s and later. So it only makes sense that now that they're sequelizing and some might argue cannibalizing all of their best movies, that they would eventually go back for Finding Dory, which reunites Andrew Stanton with Pixar. Andrew Stanton went off and did his John Carter of Mars, which didn't do
hugely successful.
Hugely successful. Didn't even make a lot of money in China. And so he's coming back here to his home in Pixar to do Finding Dory. And, you know, okay, I'm kind of the minority in this movie. I don't think this movie's very good.
Good.
And I say that as a person who moderately to mostly enjoys Finding Nemo. I don't think it's their best movie. And I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that people like about that movie, I've seen better elsewhere in Pixar's catalog. But I get it. And I think, it, you know, there's a lot of warmth and there's a lot of heart in it. And it has some fun sequences and some fun characters, and it's, you know, bounces along pretty easily. And this movie tries to do all of that, but I feel like everything that seems so effortless in Finding Nemo feels so labored in Finding Dory, and so written and so predicted. And yet it's still kind of a mess structurally, which kind of blows my mind that something could be so by the numbers and fill in the blanks, but is also a kind of unmitigated disaster as a story. So the story as it kind of exists is Dory is having all these flashbacks. As you know, Dory, the bluefish voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, who was kind of a side character in the Finding Nemo and sort of a comedic relief. In this, she's taking center stage, and her whole thing is she has short-term memory loss, which was played as a quirk at best in Finding Nemo, and now is supposed to support an entire plot. She's having flashbacks of where she originally came from. The movie kind of starts out with one of those kind of very similar to the opening of Finding Nemo, where you see Nemo's whole family get killed by a barracuda, which was actually one of the darker moments from a Pixar movie, actually. But in this one, you see how her short-term memory loss ended up with her getting lost and separated from her family when she was a guppy. And she ended up floating around the ocean aimlessly because she didn't know where she was from or where she was going. And eventually the prologue kind of bumps into where she bumps into Marlin on his way to find Nemo in the first movie. Then we jump into the future and she's having all of these kind of random flashbacks. She's beginning to remember things about where she's from, and she decides she wants to be connected to her roots, which ends up taking her to this marina down in California somewhere, big kind of preservation marina where their whole thing is they find fish that are sick or need population control or whatever. And that they, while they're fixing them up, it's kind of like a showcase or an aquarium for kids to go to. But then there's an eventual release. So it's not like SeaWorld where they're just flat out abusing fish like crazy. And it's a little ill-defined as far as, like, how enclosed are these animals? Because they seem to be able to roam freely in and out, but I don't know. It's weird. You know, she meets a bunch of characters along the way. Most prominently, she meets a octopus voiced by Ed O'Neill named Hank, who essentially kind of functions the same way Marlin did with her. And they have a very similar kind of repartee throughout the movie. He's worried and annoyed by her, and she's, you know, doing things recklessly because that's the only way she knows how to do things. And all of that's fine. We have a whale voiced by Caitlin Olsen from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. She voices a whale. That's kind of funny. The characters are fine. You know, the world building is fine. It's beautiful to look at. Even more so than Finding Nemo was, because now the technology is even further along. You know, the vistas, this ocean vistas are quite a spectacle. But the story is just a mess. You know, they can't seem to figure out her rules as, like, how bad her memory is. You know, I mean, sometimes she forgets things mid-sentence, and then other times she seems to be carrying on like a normal person for a good while throughout like an entire action sequence. She can kind of remember things just well enough to get through the action sequence. So I feel like they play really fast and loose with her memory loss, which is like supposed
Alzheimer's.
To be it's short-term memory loss.
Okay.
Which seems to be like the whole linchpin of how this whole story is supposed to work, which becomes a big problem. And then on top of it, you know, one of the things that made Finding Nemo work as a story is you had this A plot and this B plot. You had the A plot of Marlin trying to find Nemo and his odyssey through the ocean on his way to Australia to find him. But then you had the B plot of Nemo in Australia in a dentist's office and his little like gang of misfits that he makes friends with there. And both plots are equally interesting in Finding Nemo, and it's fun to bounce back and forth from them and crosscut. This movie, the B plot of Marlin trying to find Dory, is not interesting whatsoever at all. And all of the characters he meets are either the same characters we already know, or barely become anything in the story. And there's not a lot of none of them are very memorable. And Marlin and Nemo as characters, which is so surprising given that Finding Nemo was such a success and, you know, they were fully fleshed out in those movies. They're hardly characters in this movie and they're really boring. And then on top of it, the third act, and not just the third act, but mostly the third act, the movie just goes way off the rails as far as like upping the ante, the hijinks. You can tell like the writers were really frustrated with that these characters are fish and they have to be in water because they find so many excuses to get them out of water that it becomes ridiculous after a while. And I won't spoil it, but, you know, the climax of this movie, there's a car chase.
Okay.
And it feels a lot more Toy Story than it feels Nemo. And it's the movie, you know. This sounds like a bad pun, but I promise you it's not. It jumps the shark like 5 times. Bad pun accepted. It's acceptable. If you go to a movie, you're just trying to get out of the heat and you want your kids to shut up, it's not the worst thing you can ever see. But to me, this is like classic direct-to-DVD Disney sequel that didn't need to be made.
So it's mostly like a nostalgia kind of throwback.
Though. Yeah, if you know, the movie's doing pretty well, and I guess people like it. I think it's they're just remembering how much they like Nemo.
Yeah.
A little short, you know, all these Pixars have the shorts in front of them. They're so, winning at the end of the year.
It's so is there cool. any... So this is kind of... I have the opposite question for you. So you answered all my questions because I was like, is this just a nostalgia movie? Which you pretty much told me it is. And I didn't really particularly like the first one. I thought it was bright, flashy colors and silly jokes. And
yeah, and the jokes are even sillier and dumber here.
So in this one, what do you think are what are some of the positives of this film?
I said I think it's beautiful. It's really, you know, well shot is weird to say about an animated film. It's very well animated. The vistas are gorgeous. They try to go for like the emotional thing every once in a while. And sometimes it worked. Most of the time it doesn't.
Is there any characters that work?
Yeah, I like some of the new characters. I like Destiny the whale and she's friends with a beluga who I don't know who does his voice. I think Eugene Levy maybe does his voice. They're kind of fun characters, but they're integrated into the plot in such a weird way that it does never they never really feel like part of the movie even when they are. The Ed O'Neill character, he's kind of vague, like, you know, they introduce him, this octopus, as like, maybe he's a threat, and then later they're friends, but I don't know. It's just not that well written. Mostly that's the problem. Like, it's, you know, they threw a lot of money at it, the voice talent's still there, the performances are good, some of the characters are interesting, but it's all on a screenplay level. It's just not holding together.
Our reviews are very different. That's funny.
Right. I'd say wait for DVD if you must. Okay. So why don't you do a quick review for The Conjuring 2, The Conjuring?
Is it really called that?
No, I just like calling it that because of you know, you remember how after Highlander 2, The Quickening, everything was the whatevering.
No. I don't remember that, but that's a mess of a film.
Conjuring, it was like the, it was like before it was Electric Boogaloo was what you would say after every sequel, and then after that it was the Whatevering.
Oh, so this is the replacement, gotcha.
Right, yeah.
No, this is just The Conjuring 2, I believe. So James Wan comes back in to direct this. This kind of brings you in straight in with the Warrens, when before they were kind of the B plot of this film, of the first film. They're kind of the A plot in this one, and then the B plot is the haunted house stuff.
Right.
So the plot's pretty simple. Like, the Warrens go to a haunted house. Like, that's...
But this time, it's in England.
But it's in England, yes.
Enfield, in fact.
And so, I mean, plot-wise, it's not necessarily interesting, but the first one wasn't really interesting because the plot was so dynamic and new. It was because it was powerfully made. The first one, I feel like, is more powerful than the second one, but the second one has a lot of atmospheric moments that I don't think existed as much in the first one. But it's not nearly as scary. There's some really great boo scares in it. But is ever more the and again, I don't think it's as there's not as powerful of a moment. It isn't maybe necessarily edited quite as well, but it still has a lot of style and is still a pretty darn good for a ghost film. It's slick thing.
Okay.
I don't think it's necessarily as good. So if we're comparing that way, but. It rises to the occasions in some places. I think that it does. Like I said, there's these really dark, moody scenes that really pull you in. Like, if you really liked that scene in the first one where it's the girls talking about the thing in the dark.
Yeah.
That movie has a lot of those moments. It's just that it's not a, it doesn't pull you, the narrative doesn't pull you all the way through. I think also because you start with, the Warrens, the ghost exorcist hunters, whatever you want to call them.
Played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga.
That have come back for the sequel. I don't think you have as much empathy for the family, and it takes you a little bit longer to kind of get into their story and to empathize with them a little bit, but the kids still act well. The parents still act well. It's just, this is a decent sequel to a very strong first film. I actually think if this one first came out, I think you could almost say the opposite about if the first one came after, you would say, I think it's just that novelty kind of wears off and you already know what it is. But again, you're not necessarily empathizing with the family as well. And but there are moments that I feel like are darker, more rich in this film. And there's some stylistic, like visuals stylistically, and that are put together a lot better in this film. I it's a lot like the first one was kind of brown. This one is very blue and green and kind of darker and ominous and in a different sort of way.
I mean, from the trailers, it looked a lot more insidious than.
It is
the first one. I actually
definitely has hints of Insidious.
I actually really like the look of the first one. To me, that was one of the big pluses, was that it had this kind of natural lighting, and they pulled me in more because it didn't look like a big horror show.
I think it does that. It plays in between those two things. It is a little bit more Insidious, and I like Insidious. I think it's stylistic, and it's not necessarily, it's kind of, it almost play, like, his style when he does that is more like fairy tale kind of oriented horror, where it kind of goes into a certain type of feeling. Mm-hmm. And I think he's able to do that. I will say this, if you had a problem with the Warrens before, and you felt that sometimes that they were religious and fuzzy wuzzy, I felt that to be grating in this one. there were just times where I was like, okay, that's fine or whatever. please. I go back and forth because at the same time, like, you're just not used to seeing deeply religious people portrayed in this sort of film, or, well, not in this sort of film, but in this, in film like this, in a big kind of popcorn-y. But I mean, as far as popcorn horror goes, if you want to kind of like, if you want to have some jump out of your seats and you just kind of are a sucker for ghost stories, I think it works at that level.
It's a good campfire tale.
It's a good campfire tale for sure. They kind of play the same, like, this is real life, and this is one of the most, like, Enfield is supposedly one of the most documented horror houses. They even the movie actually starts with Amityville a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, they cheese that at the end of The Conjuring.
Mm-hmm. They don't go full into it. It's just more like this little episode that happens there, it kind of lingers at the first, and then finally you kind of get into and piece together the but again, I think it's enjoyable, and I think if you like the first one, I think you can dig the second one. I don't think that it's but I think if you're looking for something at the same level, the novelty effect's gone. You're not going to get it.
So it doesn't have the same kind of lingering sense of dread or tension that the first one did?
No, not at all.
It's more just kind of a big, glossy horror film.
Yeah, it's a big... Yeah, yeah. I mean, done by James Wan, so it's stylistic.
Yeah, he knows
it's pleasant to watch.
He knows where to put a camera.
Yeah, well, he knows where to put a camera, and he knows to kind of how to milk. He knows how to milk scenes. But again, it's not necessarily that deep or anything like that. It's a fun popcorn horror film.
Okay. And that pretty much covers us on the movies that we did not watch together.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about a film we actually both watched.
Now. Yeah. Which is still a 2016 film, actually. Our Netflix homework, the film Hush, which I didn't know this going in, but this was written and directed by Mike Flanagan, who also did Oculus. Absolutely. Which is a movie, another horror haunted house thing that we saw and both liked.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I guess, his follow-up to that. And I also didn't know that this movie was made for under $100,000.
Oh, wow.
Like, it supposedly had, like, this ridiculously low budget.
Well, when I think about it, it really makes sense, but...
not a lot of locations. It does,
but you don't feel that at any time.
Right.
Which is sort of... Once we get into it, I think it kind of showcases why some of that... modern exploitation doesn't completely make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you were trying to do these things on a shoestring budget, and you just, you know, you're only getting get certain kind of equipment. Now you can film things and make it look really nice on a very, very small budget. So that's sort of interesting since you brought up budget now that I'm right. talking about it and thinking about it.
I read that somewhere, and don't quote me, but I heard that it was made for an extremely low budget. And, you know, should be said, I don't think Oculus was made for a huge budget, but because that was bought out of Sundance or out of South by Southwest by Blumhouse. It wasn't one of their in-house productions.
No. I thought it was bought by the WWE. Cause I remember their little logo on it.
It might have been co-produced. Who knows?
Yeah.
But anyway, this movie is kind of a very traditional sort of home invader slasher film. And our main character's name is Maddie. She's played by Kate Siegel, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Mike Flanagan, and who is also married to Mike Flanagan.
That helps.
It does. I tend to get a lot more work when you marry the director. Ask Mila Jovovich. She plays a novelist who's trying to get away from it all. She goes to a cabin in the woods to write her book, and she's deaf and mute. And, you know, in modern day society, it's a lot easier to be deaf and mute than it would have been 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I think the movie it smartly kind of shows how much her life is sort of aided by technology. She's very connected to her phone. She's very connected to the internet. She does a lot of iChat, that kind of stuff, FaceTiming. And the movie does a pretty good job, I think, at setting up her rules as far as, like, she can read lips and, you know, how does she manage to kind of get a feel for her environment and that kind of stuff when she can't hear very well.
I think it does that in a good way, though.
No, yeah. I meant that all in a positive sense. The movie does the legwork with the character for us to understand the setup for when what eventually happens is a masked maniac in the middle of the night comes to her cabin and starts to play a long game of cat and mouse with her. And he is played by John Gallagher Jr., who we just recently saw in 10 Cloverfield Lane. And he was also one of the main actors in The Newsroom.
I was trying to place where he was from. Thank you for telling me that. I feel so much better.
Very different kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
From both of those characters I previously mentioned.
He's apparently a very good actor, yes.
Yes. This is a very lean, kind of, to the point genre horror film. And I think, and I would be interested to hear what you say, I think a very good one. I think this is a very studied kind of interpretation of this genre. And it's not reinventing the wheel. It's not really kind of doing anything super postmodern with it.
Well, it is. Not in an art sense postmodern, but it is doing it sort of in a modern term by having a deaf character in it. It's kind
right,
of
that's the hook. That's the gimmick of the movie, if you want to call it that. Is like, you know, why is this not just Halloween or the millions of other movies like Halloween? That's the angle that they're taking. But I don't see that as being particularly challenging to the genre. But what I think it is doing very well is it's just directed really, really well. These scenes play out. You get to know these two characters because it's basically a two-hander between her and this killer. And it's sort of a weird sort of relationship that builds between them as they're trying to sort of figure each other out. And they're sort of underestimating and overestimating each other through this game of cat and mouse. And I was really entertained and pulled into this movie. Not necessarily freaked out, but this genre generally doesn't freak me out. But I really had a good time.
No, this film is done very well. I was impressed that it was so minimalistically done with so mm-hmm. few characters. And it was very much cat and mouse was exactly how I would describe it. I think he goes through all of your options too, because in a lot of times I think also it's a public perception, but I don't think that it's well thought out sometimes, the arguments for those. But this film, what it does is by having such a minimalistic cast, it goes through all those concepts that people are always like, why didn't she run up the stairs? Why didn't she do this? Why didn't she try to run away and get away? Why didn't she try to do this? This kind of shows you why she couldn't do it and what's happening. I think it draws on, I would say it even draws on something like Funny Games a little bit in some of the styles, like having something happen and then it doesn't or whatever. And also just having a very tight kind of like small, intimate kind of, slasher. Mm-hmm. I thought this was really good. I mean, a little bit it is because it's so bare bones. I do kind of feel just the like, yep, I've seen this. Oh, it's done pretty well though. Okay. I don't know how much I would revisit it, but, what it really does is say, okay, that Mike Flanagan, I need to see more from him. And I would love to see more because I was really trepidatious to see, because another film that fell through because of a Relativity Media, their bankruptcy. He was supposed to have a film coming out through them called Before I Wake, I believe,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of a ghosty dream, creepy kid kind of thing.
Right.
But it makes me kind of want, it has a little bit bigger budget than I think Oculus had or this film had. And so it makes me kind of curious to see that. I do think Mike Flanagan is very talented. And I think people who didn't like Oculus are dumb. that's a mean way to say that. I don't really think that they're dumb. I just don't think that, well, no, I guess I do, because I don't really think that they didn't see the film from the perspective I did, which you could really say, are the ghosts happening or are they not?
Right.
And to me, there was some kind of like almost weird, like giallo horror kind of like weird guillotine kind of things going on in that film too.
Right. And dream logic. And yeah.
Yeah.
This movie less so.
This is pretty straight up and very nuts and bolts, but he shows that even with nuts and bolts, he can make very kind of provocative and kind of a film that's a film from a genre that's or a subgenre that's very overdone, but still make it interesting and engaging. And
what I think he did with it by not messing with it too much
mm-hmm.
is, you know, this isn't the Scream version of it, which is very postmodern. I think this version, he kind of just shows you like why we liked it in the first place.
Right.
Like before the genre became overwrought and it became all about like sequels and killer characters that you can put on lunch pails and that kind of stuff.
And gore effects and
upping the ante and just, you know, creative kills and that kind of stuff. He kind of shows us like why the minimalism of a stalker film or that. And, you know, this is unlike a lot of those movies.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't like a faceless, nameless guy. You know, he wears a mask, but he reveals himself pretty early on.
Yeah, I kept wondering about that. I don't know if that helped or hurt.
I think it helped. I mean, at first I was kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's going on now. But then I really got to like the character. I really, it kind of, I mean, if there is the one sort of postmodern thing that this movie's doing, it's that. It's sort of unmasking the crazed killer. Sure. And showing them for the insecure, bizarre, detached weirdos they actually are.
Well, I think you could argue, too, that this does that does play into a subtext, because one of the like one of the other like side plot things that is happening in this film is she has kind of a you can tell that she has kind of this weird
strained relationship,
which yeah. is also popular within the genre right now.
We saw a little bit of that in The Boy, right?
I still argue that's a better film than you thought it was, but.
I've kind of come around a little bit to The Boy, I think. I mean, I probably would never have to see it again, but I would maybe mildly recommend it to someone who was vaguely curious to see it.
Yeah,
I think this movie's better, but I both movies are similar in the sense that the female protagonist, and you could say, you know, is written, co-written by the actress who plays the character. You could read a feminist subtext in it if you want to. The fact that she's voiceless, the fact that she is, you know, I mean, the part of the cliches of sort of slasher horror is the female heroine who like has to like self-realize and take on the killer or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that the way they kind of play that against this kind of insecure weirdo male protagonist with the killer, and then also or antagonist with the killer, and then these sort of other male figures who are sort of peripheral of the story. It plays in a somewhat interesting way. I mean, I could see that essay being written, mm-hmm. but that's not necessarily what my draw was into the movie. More so than just the functionality of it.
I'm just saying that efficient. You could look at it and say it's there. With the same with The Boy. It didn't necessarily draw me in, but I was definitely like, you know, there is some of that. But anyways, no, I think that this is acceptable, and it does play in very familiar territory. So I think that the minimalistic quality of that, I think we've seen a few of those lately. So it didn't necessarily. I thought it was more interesting that your character was mute and deaf, and that you really had to play around those rules. I thought there was a specific scene towards the end in a bathroom that really did it for me, like in a more scary kind of tension building.
I mean, there's a lot, and there's a few scenes like that that I think, like I said, I'm more interested in the sort of the efficiency and the functionality of this movie.
Oh yeah, no. It does the nuts and bolts very, very well. So
yeah, it understands the genre and it really pays it off, mm-hmm. and. In a way that I thought was vaguely similar, but not tonally all that similar, but to Adam Wingard, You're Next.
Yeah. Not tonally, not at all. Adam Wingard has a lot of
stuff. That movie's a lot more rock and roll than this one. But
yeah, and I kind of prefer that. And I'm not saying this one is bad. The minimalistic quality isn't necessarily bad. It's just that I do feel like throughout the movie, I'm like, yeah, I saw that. Oh, yeah, I've seen this. But I think it challenges people's perception of this genre in an interesting way. So
okay, cool. So what are we watching next week in the Netflix homework?
An Honest Liar. It's a documentary about a guy that looks like Charles Darwin,
who apparently used to be a magician.
Yeah, and now he's like exposing. I keep thinking every time I read the plot, I kind of think of Arrested Development. That's not why I want to see see this, but I keep thinking of that. I'm interesting to see this kind of. It's one of those movies that Netflix tells me I have to watch, so I'm going to try it out. And I also like kind of dipping my toes into documentaries every so often. So
cool. And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about, and we talked about a lot.
Talked about everything.
We talked about everything pretty much. You can contact us at our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. If you want to send us death threats over Twitter, you can do that at jabberpodcast, jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can subscribe to us and listen to us through Stitcher, iTunes, Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Window Podcast Network, as well as player.fm. I have some articles written for the Seattle-based website, mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And be sure to check out friends of the show, Brad Decker and Alyssa Witte and a few of the others, the collective that put together the entertainment media blog discussion panel, whatever you want to call it, panelonframe.com. And we have friends out there who do podcasts that include Leland over at Olympia at dampercast.com, Rod and Denise in Southern California, their Music Request podcast, The Listening Party, and Patrick, who you mentioned you're going to be on Almost Educational, which is one of the podcasts he does. He also does another podcast we were both on called Make Dad Read Comics.
And that's our show. Have a good one.
Bye.